Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Final hour of Grant and Danny on 106.7 The Fan. Thank you, Pete, for getting us up to date. Next opportunity to get the latest on the sports landscape from our news desk at 1:30 right here on The Fan. Let's go to the Mattress Warehouse Hotline. Not a fun subject by any means, but a great opportunity to reminisce about one of the icons in D.C. sports who brought this town a championship with someone who knew him well. Wes Unseld obviously passing away yesterday. We talked about it quite a bit on the show, and we wanted to get another one of his teammates on today, and Kevin Grevy is kind enough to join us right now to discuss the career of Wes Unseld. Kevin, I know it's a tough time. We appreciate you hopping on. Just first, let us know what you thought when you heard the news yesterday and what came to mind.
Well, Mitch Kupchak called me yesterday morning with the news. I knew something was up because the night before, John Lally, our trainer, who kind of keeps us all informed about Wes and his situation, and I knew he was not doing well. It was Mitch that told me. And then immediately I started reaching out to some of my teammates, and all of us, you know, were just heartfelt saddened for our teammate, our big fella, our captain, our leader. All of us, and I'm sure, I mean, we love one another, and you're teammates for life when you win a championship like we did in 78. There's so many reasons that we come back together, and the Bullet Wizard organization has been unbelievable in that regard, having reunions and celebrations. And as the years were going, we saw Wes declining, and it was hard to see because, you know, he was the biggest, the baddest, toughest guy on the floor, and you started seeing him become frail, and it was not kind of hard to witness. And, you know, we just loved him. He made me a better player, a better person, and you can't talk with Wes Unseld about Wes Unseld and his Hall of Fame career and all his accomplishments. Top 50 all-time ever, and Rookie of the Year MVP in the same year, and all the things he did as a player, it would be hard to say how can somebody be a better person than he was a player. But he truly was. I mean, he lived it. He embodied, really, what you would want from a leader of any kind. He walked the walk. I mean, what he did after basketball, and he and Connie and his daughter Kimberly at the school there in Baltimore, and he was just so humble and unpretentious, amazing guy. I don't know where he got it. I know he came from an unbelievable family, but, you know, we're all fallible human beings. We all make mistakes. We're all sinners. I'm not so sure Wes is a fallible human being. He's just an unbelievable guy. And, you know, it's hard to talk to him because it's about him. You know, you do get emotional about it. I'm sorry.
It's quite all right, and it's understandable. Kevin Grevy with us here, discussing the life and legacy of Wes Unseld, a D.C. basketball giant, a guy that, for me, you know, Kevin, I'm 40, so I just remember him as a coach, GM, and it was the stories that my dad would tell that reflected, you know, what you're talking about, just how great those teams were that you were a part of, and everything else that went with that. And on the court, it sounds like that was the toughest SOB alive, but off the court, just a gentle and kind of man as you could find. Can you go into that dichotomy a little bit, that it was almost like he was a different role on the court than he was off it?
Well, that's well stated. Well, you knew he had his back. He made us all better, and he did all the little things. He was a warrior, and as the years went on in his career, I got him. My rookie year, he was in the seventh year of his career. I saw him play in college when he was like a Charles Barkley, running and jumping and flying around the court. By the time I started playing with him, he was playing with some bad wheels, a bad back, playing hurt, never complained. Back then, you played in, the era that I was playing, you played with injuries. Wes would get his knees drained and he'd go out there and give it everything he had. And he was still a force to reckon with, even with bad knees. You know, at 6'6", playing center against Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Russell, Will Chamberlain's, Artis Gilmore, Walton's, and Bob Lanier's. He still had their number. He could control the paint. And that's where the game was played back then. No three-point line. It was all about who could control the paint. And that's where Wes did it. But then off the court, as soon as the game was over, he'd puff on one of his cool cigarettes, open up a book, and the game was over. And he would move on to other things. I'm not sure he had the real love passion for the game of basketball like I had to have, because I wasn't gifted like Wes was. And he would be like the least likely guy I thought would go into coaching and scouting and be a GM and stay in the basketball business. I think he did it more as a friend of Abe Pullen's, a relationship that he had, like a father-son relationship. No, Wes was cool. I mean, when my parents would come to the games, he was just so nice to my mom and dad and my brothers and sisters. He liked my youngest brother, Norm. Norm would come in the locker room. Of course, Norm wanted to say hi to Mr. Unseld and Mr. Hayes, Wes would say, "Hey, little Greeby, can you shoot the ball like your brother?" Norm would say, "Yes, I can, Mr. Unseld." "Oh, you can. Can you score like him?" "Yeah, I can score." "So, well, what do you average in that junior pro?" He was like 9 years old. And Norm said, "I average 30.0909. And Wes started howling. And from that point on, little Norm became 30.0909. He said, "Hey, it's 30.09 coming to the game." I was like, "Yeah, Wes, he's going to be here."
That's great.
So, he was just so compassionate and calm and a sweet-spoken guy. My parents loved him, They loved him. We all did, And anybody that ever, laced up those sneakers knew that Wes was the alpha dog, but he was also our leader and our spokesperson. And no wonder the Bullets had such a storied 10, 12 years during that period of time, Wes was on that court with them. He made us all winners.
Kevin Greavy is with us on Grant and Danny, a part of that 77-78 championship team in the nation's capital. I was looking it up. It was fascinating to see. Obviously, you went to Kentucky. Wes Unseld got the first ever full ride offer from Kentucky as an African-American. Now, he chose to go to Louisville, so that's kind of an interesting history. You were there a handful of years after that. Would have been following in his footsteps. You come to Washington. He'd already played seven seasons. You're with him for his final 6 years as well. And you said at that point, he'd already been pretty banged up as a player and was still piecing it together. Can you tell us a little bit more about his relationship with Abe Pullen? You're the second. We talked to Phil Chenier yesterday and you today, and both of you have brought up how close he was with Abe. I'm interested in that dynamic between those two.
Well, he was so close to Abe that it actually caused, I think, a little friction between he and Elvin Hayes. Alvin was a little jealous of his relationship that Wes had with Abe Pullen. You know, I wasn't in any position. I was just a role player, and I kind of admired it and respected it, and it gave me more respect for my owner, Abe Pullen, to have that kind of close relationship with one of my teammates. And Abe Pullen was a wonderful man, too, and Abe recognized the character and professionalism of Wes. And they had that handshake agreement. You know, we all signed professional contracts that the league had with the owner. Wes had handshakes. He never had contracts. And I heard about it, and I talked to Wes about it, and he said, you know, Wes was never motivated by money. He was unique in that regard. Well, obviously he got paid well for that era, but, you know, we're all trying to make a living and forge a longest career we could and try to build some wealth so we'd have something at the end of the day. And that wasn't a big deal for Wes. You know, that's why, you know, he opened up his school. He had other things in mind. And all his money was put into goodwill. You know, I hope, you know, he and Connie and Kimberly and Wes are well-to-do and they got this school, but he could have been a lot wealthier man if he wanted to be, but it wasn't important to him. There were other bigger things he had to do in his life, and what a great example, you know, and these times we're in right now, we need a voice of reason, someone for like Wes Unseld, you know, our community leaders, our clergymen, and there's nobody. I mean, I would, you know, I'd hear Wes when he would speak, and we'd all listen and we'd follow. How could you not with a man like that? And his legacy will go on living in all of our lives. And your dad telling stories about Wes, I can't wait to tell stories, you know, to my kids, my grandkids about Wes. So I love that man.
Kevin, I never had a chance to meet Wes, and I think a lot of D.C. basketball fans never did as well, but we still feel like we lost a giant. We still feel like we lost somebody. I can't imagine what it's like for someone that knew him well like you and your teammates, man. Thank you so much for sharing with us, and that was really moving and powerful, buddy. Thank you so much, man. Thoughts to you.
Okay, thanks.
Be well, and we appreciate you helping us to honor the life on the air today of Wes Unseld. That's Kevin Grevy, the champion a Bullet, who, of course, for many, many years had a sports bar restaurant I've met him at. I'm sure you have, Danny, as well, here in the area, who stayed busy in the nation's capital and surrounding areas over the years. Wow, that was really, really good. Appreciate Kevin Grevy. Grant and Danny here on The Fan. Next, one of the Redskins who was supposed to have been maybe on the outside looking in is getting some attention and some positive push from his coaching staff. We can discuss that. Plus, the Skins will not be in Richmond this summer. You're listening to The Fan. Thanks again to Kevin Grevy for joining us on Grant and Danny, and to Scott Hall of the Wizards for helping us to get him on the show as well. Much appreciated. Some really good stories. I loved that he always referred to his brother as 30.09. You can imagine a little kid telling you, you know, he just punched his average into a calculator and he's giving you the decimal points as well. You can see why Wes Unseld would have loved that so much.
So funny. 30.090909.
I still remember like one rec basketball game where I scored 16 points. And I normally would score, you know, one or two baskets here or there. And this is, I'm a kid, like young elementary school. And, sure. And you don't, like, there aren't a lot of points in those games. And I don't even remember now, like I don't know now definitively if I actually scored 16 or if that's just the story I came up with, so now that's my memory.
That's what it's become, yeah.
But I remember like going into school the next day and my teacher, Mrs. Pattison, she's like, how many points did you score this weekend? I was like, 16. She's like, no way. So then later in the day she brought up that I'd scored 16 points and it just like grew from there probably. But my point is that was me in that moment. Like I was the kid telling Wes Unseld I'm averaging 30.09 points. If I dropped to 16.23, that's what he would have known me as point forward.
That is great.
But to hear Greavy getting emotional, you know, he is obviously 67 and Unseld 74. So many years removed from having played on those teams, it just tells you and gives you an indicator of what type of impact Wes Unseld had on him. So thanks again to he and Phil Chenier for joining us.
Terrific.
At a tough time to share those stories and to help spread that legacy on our platform here on G&D on 106.7 The Fan, which I think is important for those of us that didn't have the opportunity to know Unseld like those guys did. We talked at the start of the show today about the Redskins finding out with 31 other teams that they were not going to be able to go away for training camp. So no more Richmond this year, and we're on right now in Richmond, Danny. We have an audience. They carry our show on the air down in the capital of the Commonwealth. So I want to get into that part of this as well. But I've always actually been a proponent and a fan of leaving your team facility for training camp.
Maybe
it's the fact that Remember the Titans is my favorite movie ever, other than The Departed. It was my favorite movie in my childhood. I could recite the entire film for you, quote for quote. I love everything about Remember the Titans. And I know that Herman Boone thought it was so pivotal and vital. And this is, you know, in my time as a formative football fan, to get away and to have these players bond. And he's talking about going and staying in the dorms. My first time ever going to training camp in 1999 with the Redskins, who would go on to win the division championship under Norville Eugene Turner that year, with Brad Johnson throwing for 4,005 yards and Steven Davis rushing for 1,456 yards. That season, they were in Frostburg at a college campus, sleeping in dorm beds. John Jansen's on the same bed as some 115-pound freshman from Pennsylvania who's sleeping in Frostburg or Carlisle at those schools. I just thought there was a romanticism to getting away, to bonding, to being together, to not being able to go home and hang out with your family. You know, to seeing those guys ride their bikes around those little communities and getting the same ice cream lines as the Redskins fans. I've always preferred that. Richmond was the most recent version that we had, where you weren't going to be in Ashburn driving to and from, hopping on the bus from a hotel. You were going to be living dorm style or in a hotel in Richmond, as it were. You know, kind of walking around town, interacting with fans. I loved it. And the fact that it's gone this year, I understand why. But there's a chance that it could be gone for good now moving forward with the way that the deal and the contract works out between the Redskins and Richmond.
I've always been that way, too. I don't have great arguments, honestly, other than, well, it was fun when I was a kid to go to Carlisle, or it was fun when I took a trip with my dad to Frostburg, or whatever it was. You know, some people could tell me, well, actually, logistically, you get more work done if you stay there, or it's better if guys can get maximum rest and stay, you know, in their own beds and be able to see their families. You still get the meetings and you have better facilities and whatever. So cases can be made for everybody. I've generally always had that preference because of all my great buddies in high school that played football will still have memories that I didn't share in because they went away to football camp. And as miserable as it was to have a bullhorn go off in, a big makeshift dorm where you were sleeping at 5:15 a.m. to go run and you know, your head's ringing because you're hitting in the Oklahoma drill 77 times before breakfast. That stunk, but it was bonding. It was togetherness. It was something that those guys got to experience, and it was so meaningful and valuable to them, and it's something they still talk about 20, 30, 40 years later, not in my friend's cases, but decades later, with every time you see the football coach, it's a hug and it's the embrace because you went through that together. That seems invaluable to me. So I've always sort of defaulted that way too, Grant. But obviously these are extraordinary times, and I get not being able to have the sort of the same things that you're used to having. But I've always defaulted that way. And I think if it's Coach Danny over here, we're going away to football camp somewhere. We're going to have that experience like you guys had for JV, for varsity, for your, you know, college times in all likelihood. I guess those guys maybe don't go away. But you know what I mean? Like, we're doing that just because of that team-building value where you've got to hurry up and do it.
He's Danny. I'm Grant. You're listening to The Fan. You can call in and chime in on this if you'd like. The idea of going away for training camp as opposed to being at your facility, the NFL, during the pandemic, just because of the times here with COVID, wants teams at their facilities. They do not want them going off-site. They think it's easier to basically have to treat and worry about one building than having to deal with, say, if you're the Redskins Park and then Richmond and then the team hotel there and then all your meeting facilities. So they're trying to isolate everything down to your headquarters, essentially, which I totally understand. I just wonder, like we talk about with other businesses, you know, whether it's radio or TV, how many changes come out of this? My buddy, who I saw in passing this weekend for a minute or two, he said that he doesn't think he's going back to work at any point. Started working from home at the beginning of this pandemic. He got an email from his bosses essentially saying, hey, we're reevaluating some things. We're going to see what happens. Basically, he believes that he's going to be working from home permanently now, teleworking, so to speak. And I still think massively around the country there are going to be major changes made because out of necessity, mm-hmm. we became an experiment here as a workforce, I think, in a lot of ways. And we had to get by. And now you're seeing these TV networks doing shows with people all over the place on Skype, and you're not sending camera crews and sound people. And so there's going to be a lot of changes made. And why is football any different? You know, maybe this means more teams will be at their facilities if they like it, which will be a shame, I think, for fan access. You know, you think about Richmond, and maybe we can get our buddy Michael Phillips on tomorrow from the Richmond Times-Dispatch because I would love to talk to him about this. I don't know what the economic boon was and what the real overall boost was in Richmond for the Redskins being there, if they expected more than they got or what. But you just have to imagine, even still, let's say it's been a disappointment. If they're down there training for 3 weeks and all the fans that are coming down there staying overnight, I got a bunch of friends, Danny, who do this. You're eating at restaurants. You are staying in those hotels. You are going out and finding things to do and entertainment in Richmond. You're taking your kids to the little science museum that's right around the corner off of the Broad Street or whatever it is by the facility. All those things that you're doing, it's money for Richmond. So this is a big loss for them, for the Redskins not to be there this year. And potentially if they don't come back, it would be a dagger, I'd say, overall in general. We can get Phillips on to give us more info on that.
It's just quickly on it. I mean, it wasn't the boon that was promised if you're Richmond, but it's still having something, and this is kind of akin to what we're talking about with all the sports, whether it's baseball coming back or otherwise, having something's better than nothing. Like, it was advertised as, this will be transformative. You spend this money and you'll make it back 3, 4, 5, 10-fold. That never materialized, but you still spent the money. You know what I mean? Like, it's better to have it than to not have it, I would say.
We got breaking Major League Baseball news. Remember that the players sent the owners a proposal. We now know that the owners have rejected that proposal and some new details on their rebuttal as this tit-for-tat continues. So we'll get into that next on Grant and Danny here on 106.7 The Fan. Danny, it is official. Major League Baseball, according to Ken Rosenthal, has rejected the union's proposal for the 114-game season. Said it would not send a counter, sources are telling The Athletic. The league said it has started talks with owners about playing a shorter season without fans and that it is ready to discuss additional ideas with the union. The ideas Major League Baseball wants to discuss with the union are about resuming the season without fans. So this is how I read this. You know, they're not going to send them another proposal based on the one they gave them, but they're willing to re-engage, it sounds like, in dialogue. Okay. We sent you our proposal. You saw it, the 80 or so games, no prorated salaries. Then they sent you back 114 games, prorated salaries. You now say, okay, well, we're not going to send you anything back, but let's talk. We know what you want. You know what we want. And this gets back to the Jeff Passan idea from this week where, reportedly, there are owners that are willing to grant the prorated salaries if fewer games are played. He speculated maybe a 50-game season. I don't think that's going to fly. I think it's going to have to be closer than the 60 or the 65 games that Steve Phillips speculated about in his plan when he came on our show on Friday. So if you have upwards of 80 is amazing. That's what the players want. I don't know if the owners will go that far. They think they're going to lose money every single time a game is played. They claim they'll lose over $500,000 for every game that is played. But let's say it ends up being 65 with expanded playoffs. The owners get their money from the TV deal for the playoffs, and the players get their prorated cash over 65 games, more money than they'd make if it's not prorated and close to 100 games, then no one's happy, but everyone is at least getting something that they want. And sometimes the best deal means nobody's thrilled, right? I mean, everyone kind of meets in the middle.
Exactly. I want everyone grumbling when they leave the table. In this case specifically. I want everyone to feel like they got jobbed and the other side got over on them and the like. I also, and maybe this is a confirmation bias here, and I'm looking for self-affirmation, but I really do think I may be onto something when it comes to the owners are basically saying among themselves, this is the money pile we're going to use. You guys want to play two games? You guys want to play 190? Knock yourself out. This is the pile. This is all the money you're going to get this year from us. And the players are going, well, let's keep it prorated. More money. You know, we play more games, we get more money. And the owners, I think, are going privately, no, this is the pile. You're going to want fewer games. Trust me on that. We're going to make our money back. We're going to lose cash in the short term. We'll get it back and maybe hopefully turn a little bit of profit with playoffs at the end of this thing. I think that's why it's an impasse. Because if I'm an owner, I'm going, well, wouldn't more games in general, not counting their sort of their claim, I guess, or at least privately, they're saying, well, we're going to lose X amount every time there's a baseball game, which I don't necessarily know if that's true or not, but that's kind of their stance here. So they're going to want to play fewer games. But for me, intuitively, I'd go, the more times I'm on TV, the more times commercials can be sold, the more viewers I get. I know it's not ideal, but I'd be making, what, 40%, 50%, 60% of what I normally would with gate revenues and the like. Now I don't have to pay my concession employees or some of the food contracts and the things. I don't know how it would work out, but I get the sense that they're basically going, this is the pile, divvy it up how you guys want.
When we went on the air on Monday, my take then, and it is the exact same now, is that 7 days from the start of the show on Monday, we would have a really good idea if there was going to be baseball or not. And I'm going to keep going with that. Because I believe in what Passan and so many others have said who are talking to people on both sides, that the clock is ticking and there is just so little time here. And if we're actually going to play enough games to appease and satisfy the players, and forget the players versus the owners for a second, if we're going to play enough games, Danny, to actually make all this worthwhile, you can't play 50 baseball games without expanding the playoffs and justify the entire process. Not only the money lost, but the risk the players are taking on. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. So it's now June. That plan that came out a month ago that we all went giddy for and threw parties about, remember, spring training was supposed to start a week from today. That's not happening.
Right.
So now you start to think, okay, let's just look at the calendar. If you show up for spring training in late June, if you start playing in mid-July, how do you fit enough of these games in? It's unrealistic to expect to play without days off for months with a bunch of doubleheaders, which the players are suggesting. But here's the problem with that. Now you're talking about, you know, a lot of Wilmer Defoe and less Trey Turner. You're talking about a lot of, you know, your backups kind of playing because it's been 14 straight days with three doubleheaders. That's not what people are looking for either. They want baseball as close to the real deal as they can get it. And so I think that now is the time. The owners got to send their offer that was absolutely unacceptable for the players. The players get to counter and send something back that the owners never thought once about saying yes to. That's how every negotiation since the beginning of time has kind of gone between a union and a company, right? Normally you have more time than we have now, and that's my fear. But we're on schedule here if what is being reported is correct and the players are willing to play around 80-plus games potentially if they get their prorated salary, which was the original agreement. They get half of their money. And the owners are willing to play that many games if it means that we get to expand the playoffs and they make more money on the back end. So we're at a place where I can see now some sunshine creeping into the tunnel up ahead. I don't know if it's going to work out or not, but I was worried a few days ago, and I feel a little bit better now.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's where I am, too. I always thought they would work it out in some way. I really did, and it's easy to say now, but I always did. But I did have I went from a 0% or like a 0.1 fraction of a percent that there wouldn't be baseball to there's a legitimate chance this isn't going to happen, right? So I don't know what the percentage was. Call it 25, 30, whatever. Because the one report that jumped out at me was kind of buried within the other parts of this. I think it was Jeff Passan that had it. Was there's a faction of owners that thinks we just shouldn't do this year at all. And I went, whoa, that wasn't on the table. What are we talking about here, right? We all seem to have the same goal in mind, right, which is that baseball. But if there's a loud enough faction that that word gets out that we don't want to do it, I'm going, well, wait a minute, maybe there's a non-zero chance now. So I feel better today than I did, I'd say, a couple days ago about it happening. You're still, you know, a bad negotiation or a bad setting or a bad email or whatever away from people throwing up their hands and saying, screw this, I'm not talking to that guy. But I am more confident than I was before. I think you said it right.
If you want to hop in on Grant and Danny, discuss this or any of the things we've talked about, the phones are always open for you at 800-636-1067. This date in Nats history during our final segment next. This date in Nats history coming up in 4 minutes. We're Grant and Danny. You are listening to 106.7 The Fan. Dak Prescott today pledging $1 million for police training. I think that's a really smart use of his money and a really good cause during what's going on. You know, you've been on record, Danny, saying you're not sure how much all the statements and the things help, but so many athletes are doing so much good at a critical time in this country. Dak raising some awareness by saying, look, I'm going to put $1 million toward better educating police officers so that some of the brutality that takes place and the racial injustices that you see in these videos far too often dissipates. You put $1 million where your mouth is, just like Kaepernick did, by the way. People were so up in arms about
That's
Kaepernick,
right.
But what I always admired was after the fact, you know, when all the arguing and the loud shouting and the dumb back and forth about whether or not, you know, he was being disrespectful to the flag. I mean, he took a silent protest, which is one of the more American things you could done, put a knee down, didn't bother anybody around him. And people were very bothered because he was doing it during the national anthem, right? Okay, but after that, what did he do? And he spent a lot of money, and he spent a lot of time, and he did a lot of things. Well, Dak Prescott taking $1 million to improve police training. Imagine if you had, you know, dozens of athletes come forth and do that, what that money could end up doing to help with some of that training.
Absolutely. And again, that's what I care about. So to me, the Kaepernick issue, everyone wanted to make it a singular one deal, right? So my stance, I happen to think you should stand for the anthem. That's as passionate as I get about it. I stand because you don't have to. I think that's the beauty of the country. You don't want to? Okay, you do what you want. But you could probably expect a little bit of backlash from it. I've never thought it should be this front and center thing and turn into what it turned into, and it became a touchstone and it was too much. I cared about other things, like his praise of Fidel Castro, like the pig socks that he wore, or some of the other stuff that everybody kind of conveniently forgets. I didn't enjoy those things. I thought they were wrong. Here's what I thought was right. Putting your money where your mouth was, putting your time and energy where your mouth was, and doing a lot of good that ostensibly helped people with that platform. I cared about that way more than the specifics of a gesture. So the balance sheet looks a certain way differently to me than it does, I think, to a lot of people. But statements are good. I'm not anti-statement. Good, make your statement, but good for Dak Prescott to again contribute to a cause that he believes will do some good. I'm in favor of that way more than I am, you know, taking a picture of your note section on your iPhone and telling me how concerned you are.
And as an aside, I'm always amazed by, I've just seen some of the reaction, and I always have to remind myself that social media and Twitter is you know, just different than the real world, and it's way more negative and kind of in a vacuum. But just seeing some of the reaction via social media to the announcement today, you know, what is $1 million going to do to help this cause? Well, it could potentially do a lot of good. I mean, you're isolating it to part of this very real conversation about the education and training of police officers. $1 million is a lot of money. I think that's, you know, really a great gesture for him. And if that is met with, if giving $1 million out of your bank account to help a cause, to try to better a cause, is met with kind of scrutiny, I hate to think what people, I mean, what did you think yesterday of someone just posting an Instagram box on their account then? You know, that's $1 million.
Right.
And it's not like he's just pledging it to some random thing. He's directing it exactly at something that a lot of people feel like we're talking about right now. It needs to be fixed. So kudos to Dak Prescott. It is time for this date in Nats history. So we look at the calendar, June 3rd. And we see how far we got to go back. Today, 6 years to the date in 2014. People sleep on the fact that the Nats have had this routine. It is kind of their bit to get off to a really bad start and then get hot as the year goes along and finish on fire. They did it in 2014 as well. A win on this date got them to 500, 28-28. They ended up winning 96 games and their second division championship in 3 years. On this day, Jordan Zimmermann threw 8 shutout innings against the Phillies, and Anthony Rendon carried the offense as we go back in time.
Span off first, the pitch. Rendon hits one in the air to deep right center field, sending Revere back to the warning track. He turns to watch, and it is gone! A long, soaring opposite field home run for Anthony Rendon, his 7th of the year. It's a 2-run shot, and the Nationals are pouring it on the Phillies. The Nationals 7, the Phillies nothing.
Jeeps, was that the year you and I did that like symposium at a library? Was that that season where they got off to that
feels
just okay
right.
start?
I don't remember the date. I know that was one of the coolest events you and I have ever done.
It was so much fun.
The Pohick Library, correct?
Yeah, that's a great poll. All we did basically was talk baseball. So at the All-Star break, there were 9 games. I think this is right. There were 9 games over 500. And people are – basically the question, it was repeated in like 77 different ways, was why aren't they better? What's going on? And you and I both kind of went – listen, look at their runs scored, runs allowed. Look at their Pythagorean wins and losses. You're basically talking about a team that's about to take off. And at the All-Star break, July 13th, they were 51-42. They would finish the season with a record of 96-66. So you don't have to do the math in your head. Just know they took off and caught fire and kicked everybody's butt and left everyone in the rearview mirror.
Loving going back in time. Normally you get these random names. Nothing random about Jordan Zimmermann and Anthony Rendon that day. Although I will say, Jordan Zimmermann, because of how his post-Nationals career has unfolded, is never going to get the appreciation, I don't think, from this fan base that he probably deserves. He was so good. 2012, he had a sub-3 ERA. The following year in 13, he had a 3.2. 2014, he was one of the league leaders with a 2.66. From 12 to 15, basically, his final year here, he was amazing. I mean, one of the best pitchers in baseball, finished in the top 7 in Cy balloting, you know, multi-time All-Star, was more consistent during that run than Strasburg was. Probably should have pitched over him in some of those playoff starts that he didn't get to make. In fact, he was unbelievable in one of his starts against the Giants at Nats Park. Remember, he got taken out, like flirting with a no-hitter most of the night in the 8th inning, having given up one hit, I think it was, or something before his second hit, and Matt Williams went to Drew Storen and blew the game. But then he goes to Detroit, and in the American League, he's completely fallen apart over the last 4 years. But, man, was Jordan Zimmermann a stud for a while.
So you never got the credit he deserved because he was 20-19 pitching record-wise over 2 years. He had a worse season anecdotally and statistically in all the counting-type stats, but finally stopped having bad luck and won 19 games and was a Cy Young finalist. You see what I mean? It's the reason you and I are champions. We hold up Mjolnir and fly through the air telling you how stupid pitcher wins are.
Today's big development in DC sports, the Wizards will get to play more basketball if and when the NBA resumes in Orlando. They are the last team in. They have been added to the pool in the Eastern Conference. So they will get 8 more games, and if they can pull to within 4 games, they'll be able to keep playing into a tournament with the top 8 teams in the conference. With Thom and Brendan, your new Sunday afternoon show. Danny and Grant saying so long here on The Fan.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.